Blog Talk Radio.
And now a brief message from our sponsor. Reality Books presents Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. The author is Marshall Washington Cabinus Abui, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, a message that will change America. Buy your copy today. $20 is all it costs, plus $5 postage and handling. To order your copy of the book written by the great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, send a text message. Include your full name and how many books you would like to purchase. Send to area code 706-399-5006. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A message that will change America. Send your text message, including your full name and how many books you would like to purchase, to area code 706-399-5006. And now a brief word from our sponsor, Reality Books, publisher of Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. A short extract from the book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. God will not change the condition of a people until they change what is in themselves. In other words, until they change their way of thinking. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution is designed to help African Americans and other ethnicities change their way of thinking. This is a book that will change America, and it is on sale for only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. You can order your book now by sending a text message to area code 706-399-5006. Please put your name and the number of books that you would like to order, and you will be contacted to arrange payment information so that the book can be mailed to you immediately. So please go ahead and don't hesitate. Order your copy today. Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution, published by Reality Books. The author of this book is the great-grandson, the senior great-grandson of Booker T. Washington, the founder of the famous Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, now known as Tuskegee University. The great-grandson of Booker T. Washington is inviting you to order his book. Send a text to area code 706-399-5006. The book is only $20 plus $5 postage and handling. Order your copy today. Thank you.
Well, good evening. Good evening, everyone, and welcome again to Booker T. Washington, African American Family Room Forum. And we are welcoming you on this first official Saturday of fall 2021. And as we begin to get cooler weather here, even in the South, I'm in Augusta, Georgia, and it's starting to get cool in the evenings and it's cool early in the morning, and it does warm up into the 80s by midday, but we know that that won't last long, that usually by the end of October, it's starting to get really chilly, but it never gets really cold here, but we expect it's going to get increasingly cooler. And wherever you are, we hope that the weather this fall is going to be comfortable and not dangerous, because we've seen some dangerous weather already as we came out of the summer. And we hope that the conditions will be such that this will be a safe fall and winter for all of us. We want to say thank you for joining us tonight, and before we go any further, I do want to ask my co-host, Mr. Bianchi, for a radio check. Mr. Bianchi, are you able to hear me?
Oh, you sound like Bistro. Bistro.
Bistro. You're funny. Okay. Mr. Bianchi and Brother Warren might know something about Bistro. Maybe they have that terminology down there in the New Orleans area. You know, we didn't have Bistros. Where I came from a little southern town, as you know, and we had a couple of juke joints, but that was about as close to any kind of bistro that we ever got. But anyway, thank you for giving me a good radio check. Before we go on, and I'll bring you on in a second, this will be caller's choice tonight, so whatever is on your mind, panelists, just go ahead and let us share your thoughts. Tell us what's on your mind, and if you'd like, you know, we'll give you our feedback. But I do want to let the internet audience know that we welcome you participating. We encourage you to call in if you have something on your mind that you'd like to share with our audience tonight. The number to call is 657-383-0671. 657-383-0671. And before I bring you on, Ms. Bianchi, I do want to let you know that after the show last week, I did pull up that piece by Jimmy Walker, and it's a little bit beyond my talent, not talent, but my range of what I would say. I haven't got there yet. I'm probably in another month, give me about a month, because I'm going to be working on it. I should be able to give you some of it. I might not be able to play the whole piece, but because it is a little complicated, but I definitely plan to work on it. I'd like to reach that level. So trust me, I will be working on it. But having said that, do you have anything on your mind that you'd like to share with us tonight, Mr. Bianchi?
Well, I remember asking Warren to come on this week and tell us about those jukebox joints, like you just got through mentioning. I've heard a lot of them about going on down the south of Louisiana, them back roads, wooden floor, doing the stomp, and so on and so on. I don't know if they still exist. And you made mention of Junior Walker way down home. That's a classic. I really like that. I can listen to that over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's a good piece. And as I said, I will be working on it. It's a really fast-moving piece. But it's a very, very exciting piece, and playing it will definitely be taking me up to another level. So I will be working on it, but I'll go ahead if you want. Brother Warren, who I welcome, and also Sheikh John Kennebay, who I welcome. If you want him to go ahead and respond about the juke joints down in the New Orleans area, you know, that would be okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, greetings, everyone there. I'll respond to what the co-host asked to hear, and then I want to go on what was on my mind. Here, New Orleans is a unique place, even in the South, because it's a ballroom city. And among the white people, it's a bar culture. And among the black people, it's a bar culture. And my family members own bars and stuff here. And, you know, you also refer to them as hole in the walls here in the city. I'll get to the rural part. And so bar rooms, even today, are the social life of New Orleans. So if you would, if you're moving to New Orleans or you're working here and you want to get into the vibe of what's going on, you go to bar rooms. And they're all kind of bar rooms here. So you find professional blacks going to bar rooms as well as working class and unemployed blacks going to bar rooms. They're not places where their fights break out and shooting. You know, that would be something more among the younger people in many places. And so when I was a kid, because when I was coming up as a kid, you know, young kids were able to go in the ballroom, not to drink, but to, like, if your parents was in there or something, you were able to go in there. I remember that. And, you know, the music, you had the jukeboxes, you listened to the music. And, we, you know, we have some of the greatest rhythm and blues performers came from here, Fats Domino, and Fats Domino composer and arranger, Dave Bartholomew, was the guy that wrote a lot of Fats Domino song, and we had people like the one who did Bad Leroy Brown in Personality, Lloyd Price, who died recently, was from the area. And then you had the Dixie Cups, who sang Going to the Chapel, Going to Get Married. I know a couple of them. And then you had people like Ernie Cato, who sang the song Mother-in-Law. Y'all remember that hit, Mother-in-Law. And so I had a chance to cross paths with these people over the years and as a kid and coming up and know them. And this was rhythm and blues performers in addition to jazz performers. In the rural areas, very interesting, particularly the rural area where many of my family members live, because one of my grandparents come from this area, around Alpaloosas area. The black people are French speakers. They're Creole speakers mostly. And the music that they listen to is a black version of Cajun music, which we call Zydeco. And the places did have wooden floors, and they would dance to the two-step. And the band would consist of an accordion. You would have with the accordion, the washboard you call a fatwa, the washboard you play, the drummer, you have your bass, your guitar, and the people would dance to that music, and the floors would shake, and it was like you on the air, two-step. That still goes on in those areas there. So, that was a part of this area down this way. Baton Rouge was a blues hall area too. Oh, Baton Rouge got some great blues musicians come out of there. They had people called Tabby Thomas. If you all ever saw this movie called Brother, Where Art Thou? And the black guy who played the blues musician, well, that was Tabby Thomas' son. And then you had people like Silas Holden and all them. That was Baton Rouge blues. And the blues from the Baton Rouge area along that river had a droning sound to the guitar, almost like a hypnotic sound there that you had there. And so Baton Rouge is a very important blues place for music there. So all over the South Louisiana, out of South, your places where blacks would drink, your halls and all that are interesting. In northern Mississippi, not the what they call the Delta area, but in the northern hill country of Mississippi, you had black blues performers who had these yard parties. And it was almost like, I had a chance to visit up there a few times. It was almost like you was back in time. You had people still making the moonshine whiskey, catfish sandwiches, and the people playing that hypnotic blues. So much so that I had a chance, the few times I went, there were white people from all over the world would go visit the hill country of Mississippi to hear some of these blues musicians up there. So that's pretty much how that is on the music front.
Well, I want to chip in and ask a question. Can I ask a question right quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Brother Warren, I just did a quick research concerning black musicians, famous black musicians that came from New Orleans, and it said that Louis Armstrong came from New Orleans, but was he actually from New Orleans or from some other part?
Yes, indeed. He was from New Orleans, yes, indeed. In fact, the neighborhood where he lived, the house where he was born in is the first district police station was built there in the 1960s. But he's from New Orleans, absolutely. The New Orleans man.
All right. Okay, well, good. Well, you can continue on if you want to do so, or you want to pass it on to John. Go ahead.
He talking about them catfish sandwiches. That remind me of when we used to go the Horseshoe Lake when we was kids, Papa Nella. Old man bang. They used to call him Papa Nella. He had mules in his backyard, horses, but he had a big old truck, sideboards on it. He filled that bad boy up with hay and straw, load up a bunch of kids and drive us to Horseshoe Lake, and they'd have a big fish fry. And, man, that was some of the best fish I ever ate. Catfish sandwich with mustard on it. But did they have any harmonica players down there, Warren?
They call them harps. Harps is what the older people call the harmonicas, harps. Yeah. From the rural areas, you mostly had that. All back again up there around the Baton Rouge area. And when you go along that Mississippi River, some of those communities going up all the way to like Mississippi state line, a lot of those kind of people came from there. There's one called Buddy Guy. Now, Buddy Guy is in Chicago, but Buddy Guy comes out of Pointe Coupee Parish, and he played the guitar. In fact, he's like an heir right now to B.B. King, I would say. I'm not into his music per se, but he's big. He's a multimillionaire. And then we had one called Lazy Lester, came from the same area. So, yeah, the harmonica. Oh, Slim Harpo. You listen to Slim Harpo. He was from Port Allen. Slim Harpo played the guitar, and he had a song called You Scratch My Back, I Scratch Your Back, was one of his hits. He played the harmonica. He played the harmonica and the guitar. And on some of his cuts, you hear him play both of them. Yeah. Slim Harpo.
Well, the Coco Teller was a favorite of mine, and that one song, I'm a Woman. But did she ever play down there in New Orleans? Because she had a harmonica player, man. That man sounds just like a train coming. I mean, that's some of the best sounds that you ever want to hear.
Yeah, they've had blues festivals here. She's performed down. I recall her performing down here. Yeah. She talking about you. She recorded a response version to Muddy Waters, I'm a Man.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, I'm a
Woman.
Talking about
Muddy Waters. Now, Lil Walter, according to what I just read, came from a part of Louisiana, but not necessarily New Orleans. But did he, before he went up to Chicago or wherever he hooked up with Muddy Waters, did he make any name for himself down in New Orleans area? Do you know Lil Walter
was from a place called Marksville, Mansour. That's Evans Parish. That's where he's from. I don't know if he had made a name while he was here, because I know a lot of people they became known once they left and went to places like Chicago and recorded and stuff like that.
Okay.
You know. So, you had. You know, it's a lot of music come out of here. And even in jazz, one of the things all the big jazz orchestras like Duke Ellington or Count, they always wanted a musician from New Orleans. Mm. And Duke Ellington had a clarinet player called Barney Bigard. In fact, if I hear any New Orleans musician from any of those bands, I know they're from New Orleans just by the way they play. And Barney Bigard.
Really?
Had,
what is,
huh? Huh?
What is it unique about the New Orleans sound? Take, for example, a clarinetist.
New Orleans jazz was basically a blues sound. It has the blues. So we listen to Sidney Bechet, Barney Bigard, and others. You hear a clear blues sound. In fact, Duke Ellington said when he was a kid in D.C., and Sidney Bechet would perform, that's when he was inspired, the way he heard Sidney Bechet. So New Orleans jazz musicians had that blues in the playing of the instruments, more so than anybody else. They had a deep a blues sound with their playing.
I'm glad you said that, because I'm playing the clarinet, and I would like to be able to get familiar with some of those New Orleans clarinetists. So I can pick up some of that style.
Listen to a cat named George Lewis. Go to YouTube. George Lewis was old time. He's dead. Oh, when he played some of those hymns, like Just a Closer Walk with Thee, What a Friend. Oh, yes, indeed.
Okay, George Lewis. Okay, well, great.
Yeah.
Well, I know Sister Bain has been waiting, but it's Sheikh John Kenneth Bay turn, so we're going to turn it over to him and hear from him, and then after him, Sister Baina. So, Sheikh John Kenneth Bay, what's on your mind tonight?
Good afternoon, everyone. Actually, I've been watching a PBS a documentary on Muhammad Ali. So I was wondering, Marsha, could you share some information about your experience due to the fact that he was with the Nation of Islam?
Well, thank you. I didn't really get to know the champ, really know him, but I did have a chance to have a couple of encounters with him. The first was before I joined the Nation of Islam, about a year or so before I joined the Nation of Islam, when he was actually in court in Atlanta. You know, he was just recently been cleared to go back to fight, but he had to find a state that would give him a boxing license. And so Georgia, through the efforts of a black state senator by the name of Leroy Johnson, who I knew very well because I rented office space in his office building, he was a black senator, which was very, very uncommon back in the 60s. I don't know if he was the first black senator, but he was a very prominent politician who became a black senator. And he arranged for Muhammad Ali, who at that time was still known as, he had become Muhammad Ali, but people still generally called him Cassius Clay. This was in, I think, 1967. So he had been down in Atlanta for the purpose of going through the process of getting his boxing license down there so he could do his comeback fight down there. And he used to hang out at a popular restaurant down on what used to be called Hunter Street, now it's Martin Luther King Drive. And it's called Pasco's Restaurant. He used to hang out when he was in town. Everybody hung out at Pasco's. And I remember encountering him down there, you know, being a superstar such as he was. He had a lot of the college girls from the campus, nearby college campuses, Spelman, Clark, Atlanta University, Morris Brown, that came out and, you know, grouped to just be able to see him. And I don't know if he was signing autographs, but they just wanted to stand around and just see the champ. I didn't really talk to him at that time, but I got a chance to see his personality, very friendly guy. But then later, when I had become a member of the Nation of Islam, and I was actually inducted into the Nation, and I don't know if that's the correct word, but I went into the Nation of Islam in San Francisco, and he came out there just to visit. I don't know what other business he had in San Francisco, but he had been made a captain in the Fruit of Islam, and that was like almost the highest, that was the second highest rank, you know, in the Nation of Islam, the first highest being the minister. And in some places, the captains actually, for practical purposes, had more power than the ministers. For example, up in New York, the brother who was the captain in New York, he actually had more power than Louis Farrakhan, who was a minister up there, even though Farrakhan was more famous, you might say, but I did sit next to, my point is that I sat next to Muhammad Ali at a meeting in the mosque. Got a chance to shake his big hand. Man, has some big hands. And I have large hands, but, you know, his hand definitely enfolded my hands. You know, he didn't seem to be that big when I would see him in the ring on TV, but when I got next to him, you know, Muhammad was about 6'4", or something like that, and he had these big old hands, and he was just an impressive guy. He had an aura about him that I don't even know if it had anything to do with him being the heavyweight champion of the world. And at that point in time, I think he was not in the position of heavyweight champion of the world. I think he had been knocked out of that position for a minute, but he got it back. But he just had a special aura that made you like him, not just because he told jokes. He liked to crack jokes. But he just was such a friendly guy, you know. I mean, on the one hand, you know, he was the kind of guy, get him in the ring, and he'd knock you out cold. But be around him, and you would think he was the nicest guy you ever met in your life. And that was my personal experience with him. As I said, it was very, very, very limited, but it was definitely made a great impression on me.
Mr. Washington.
Yes, sir.
And who is this? I came across this guy on YouTube. Who is this Imam Sir Hyde something? He split from the Nation.
Yeah, Siraj Wahaj. Siraj.
Oh yeah, yeah. Something. I was just looking at some of his stuff. I didn't know who he was.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I don't know Siraj, Imam Siraj, at all. I, like you, have seen some clips of him on YouTube. I don't know a lot about his history, but I know that at one time he had been what we call through the Nation. You know, some people, you know, came in, they might have stayed for a year or less. Some may have stayed longer. But he actually had, I think, begun to associate after Elijah Muhammad died, I believe for a short period of time, he associated with the son of Elijah, Wallace Muhammad.
Right.
But he tended more towards the traditional Islamic theology and traditional culture. And so the people that he was most impressed by, it seems, now, I didn't know him personally, but I studied him, were the people from overseas, like Pakistanis and Arabs.
Yeah.
Even though Wallace D. Muhammad befriended a lot of those people and was taught by a number of those people, he was more independent. He came up with a lot of concepts, basically, that I would say were his own understanding, his own, you know, concepts. Because he was a Quran scholar and a Bible scholar, but he also was a very, what I would say, dedicated human rights and black rights leader. So he put all that together into a movement type of theology or philosophy, whereas Siraj kind of went more toward the foreign immigrant, what we call immigrant concepts. But let me just say this. It seems from what I understand, from what I heard, that towards the end of Wallace Muhammad's life, because Wallace Muhammad died rather unexpectedly, he had some health issues, diabetes being one of them. Maybe heart trouble being another one, but it wasn't advertised a lot among his followers. But I happen to know about the diabetes because he had mentioned it once at a health meeting that I attended, where he was giving a talk about some health products he was selling, and he mentioned about his diabetes. But the thing about it was that towards the end of his life, it seemed like that Siraj was trying to get closer to him. He never did, from what I understand, come up under his umbrella altogether, but it seemed like he was trying to reconcile with him, because I won't say he had criticized him so much as I would say that he had basically, from what I could see, pushed back on some of the concepts that Wiles Muhammad had. And but I don't know a lot about what he's doing right now. I know he has a mosque, he has a movement, I think, up in the New York area somewhere. But that's about all I can tell you about him.
Yeah, because I saw the clip where he talked about how he said that Wallace Dean graciously gave him the blessing to go his way, and that Wallace Dean actually came down to that mosque so there would be no confusion in front of people and encouraged him to go his separate way and everything. But he did pay homage that. But anyway, I just brought that up because I had just come across that guy on a YouTube channel, and I wasn't, you know, sure what, you know, I mean, from the way it seemed, I got that he was all in with a lot of these other Muslim groups from around the world and stuff. I got that, but I do know a lot of African-American Orthodox Muslims who try to find a mosque in a city that are with African-American. They pick up the prejudice from the South Asian and Arab Muslims. And he seemed,
yeah,
because I saw one clip where he was asked a question about that, and he kind of evaded that question, and he put the racism on the Nation of Islam, and he didn't address the issue of the South Asian and Arab prejudices against blacks, even in those countries where they come from, much less mentioned here. So I kind of picked up what kind of politics he plays.
Yes. I don't know a lot about him, but maybe when I come back around, I will address some of the issues you just mentioned about the racism that some of those people from Southeast Asian communities, even Arab communities, that they sometimes display concerning African American people. I'll talk about that for a minute later.
I'm gonna say this. I'm gonna be quiet, respectfully. I was in Senegal in August, and of course I've been to Senegal before in Mali. And those people are more religiously Muslim than the Arabs. They are more devout followers of Islam than those Arabs, and they're theologians in Islam. In fact, I went to a mosque one time. it almost sounded like he was in the Baptist church because they was kind of making like little sounds of agreement to the imam.
Yeah.
Imam,
yeah, that's an
interesting
point.
I couldn't understand the wallah from that like that.
Well, I would love to get to West Africa. I've been to North Africa, to Morocco, and to Egypt, and I've been to Djibouti on the eastern side of Africa, but I haven't been to West Africa. So I have many friends from West Africa, from Mali, from Senegal, from Sierra Leone, from Gambia, from Nigeria. So they've invited me to come there and visit them, and I'm certainly looking forward to it in my lifetime, God willing. But I don't want to take any of Brother Sheikh John Kenneth Bay's time. Sheikh, did you have – well, let Sheikh come back if he wants to say more. Ms. Bianca, let's see if
okay.
He's finished yet. Did you finish, Sheikh John?
Yes, I'm enjoying listening to the conversation. Continue.
Okay, good. Okay, well, Ms. Bianca, go ahead, and then we'll go to Sister
Ben,
and then we'll go to Sister Stephanie.
I was going to tell Warren there in Senegal, there's a city – called Touba, and that's where the big mosque is.
Yeah.
And Tubians, they are some very, very well-to-do people. They Muslims.
Yeah, I've been there.
And
yeah.
Have you ever heard of them?
Yeah, I've been to the big mosque of Amadou Bamba.
Yeah.
The guy mosque there. Yeah, I've been to the tomb. I've seen the tomb. Yeah.
And they don't depend on the government. Anything that needs to be done, they do. I think that mosque has got a gold band all the way around it. And Tubans go all around the world and establish businesses, just like the Mormons do, Mr. Washington. You'd be surprised. But they are like a group.
The Murid sect, yeah.
They're a sect, yes.
Yeah,
they something
yeah.
else, I tell you. Did you get to go to Gory Island?
I didn't go this. I've been before. I didn't go this time. I was in Dakar, and I went up to the Senegal River, and I actually went into Mauritania. I went over to Mauritania.
Well, I'm going to tell you something. If you go to Gory Island, make sure you're sober, because the most beautiful women in the world is on Gory Island.
Okay.
And they will hypnotize you.
Okay. Wow. Well, that puts a different light on the whole subject. But I do want to not hold back on bringing on Sister Baina. So, Brother Warren, Mr. Jack, if you permit, let's go ahead
and give way
to Sister Baina. Sister Baina, what's on your mind?
Okay. Peace and blessings. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine.
Okay, my concern is about the feminization of black men and boys. I noticed that we have a lot of brothers out in Hollywood wearing dresses. And I have come to the conclusion that this is an extension of the Meritorious Manumission of 1710. And if you don't know what the Meritorious Manumission is of 1710, long story short, it is an act that made it legal, the legal act of freeing a slave for good deeds as defined by the national public policy. And now the meritorious manumission could be granted to a slave who distinguished himself by saving the life of a white master or his property, inventing something that a white slave master could make a profit from, or snitching on a slave rebellion. Malcolm X called these people the house Negroes. Some people put the Texas Ranger David Armstrong, the Amber Geyer case. It's a form of denouncing your brother in modern day 2021. And, or, you know, either denounce your brother, we won't let you in, type Ben Carson. They classify him on this level. Kamala Harris, Candace Owens, and other people. Why I'm concerned about this is that Lil Nas, okay, let me name these people that I know have been wearing dresses. Billy Porter, Lil Nas X, Russell Westbrook. What's going on? So many African-American men of slave descent are wearing dresses. So I'm thinking that, you know, you're trying to feminize African-American men. And it started with the Obama administration. When they said that someone put it on the front cover of the magazine, I forgot which magazine was that, we got our first gay president. They offer these people double benefits, and they usually are dating white men. Okay, and there are codes that were set up in this country that African American men have to follow, such as you cannot fight back if a white man was beating on you, or if you were in a white man's presence, you had to remove your hat. You know, you couldn't speak unless you took your hat off. They have these codes, and if you violate those codes, they would lynch you. Some of the codes were like they hung like 2,600 black lynched or castrated them for robbery, wife beating, writing insulting letters, gambling, those kind of things. But I'm concerned, and tying this black men wearing dresses to the Meritorious Manumission Act. And I'm really concerned because they're pushing this stuff into the elementary schools. And Lil Nas took a picture of himself like he was a pregnant woman. And some people are saying that this is just free expression. And I recognize that people have the right to wear whatever they want to wear. But when I'm tying it in to the Meritorious Manumission of 1710 Act. So I would like to know how other people are viewing men, African American men wearing dresses. I see it as a way of weakening black men because they're not shooting black women, they're not shooting any other people down in the street. They're shooting black men down because I see it that as a way of weakening the black man as much as you possibly can, so he gets to the point where he cannot fight back. And, you know, so I still see this as tying all this into the Meritorious Manumission Act of 1710. So what are your feelings?
Okay, let me break in, Sister Banner, because I do want to get responses from the panelists on that, and I know that's what you want, but because we only have about 20 minutes left, because I had planned to stop the show at 9 o'clock tonight, and we do have a couple of other people. We want to hear their first inputs, Sister Stephanie, and then we have a caller from the 352 area code, and I'm not sure who that is, but we want to give that person a chance to give what's on their mind, and then we'll come back and let people respond to what, you know, what they want to respond to concerning what anybody else has said, in particular what you just said.
Okay.
But let
All
Sister
right.
Stephanie
Thank
give her input first. So, Sister Stephanie, welcome to the show, and what's on your mind tonight?
Well, thank you. Hi, everyone. Whoo, I'm full. I just had me a giant tostada, and it was delicious.
Wow. Okay.
And pink lemonade. But, you know, that's something, Sister Baena, all these men in dresses and makeup and things like that, feminine styles, you know, who? And believe me, it's not just the black men, and it's not just the men either. It's these women, too. It's a new day and a new world, and that's the way they roll, unfortunately. They say they're born like that. It used to be a person when something horrific has happened to them in their life as a child, and that's usually the way they would turn out. There's a boy that walks past my house. I think he's about 18 years old. He's been walking past for a couple of years. I used to see him when he was in high school. He's a recent graduate, but he switches down the street. And it's a black boy. And he's very kind, though. And I always wonder what happened to him to make him like that. Now, today, my husband and I were sitting on the front porch, and people pulled up, another black couple, a husband and wife, and they just wanted to introduce themselves since we all live in the same neighborhood. And it's not very many of us. And this, come to find out, they were his parents. And they seem very, very normal, you know. Like I do dialysis. And at the dialysis center, there was an Asian guy. And he had this really long hair, and he wore it in two ponytails like a little girl. And the ponytails would have pink ponytail holders, one on each side. And, you know, he's... made it very obvious that he's gay, but which didn't bother me none. That's him, you know. But one day he told me that I'm going to, after he stuck me really hard with a needle, he said, I'm going to have some bad days. Because I told him, you can't ever stick me again. He said, well, you're going to have some bad days. Every monkey has a bad day. So I reported him. He's been fired. You know, you're not going to sit up here because you got problems of identity problems and then call me a monkey. And I'm old enough to be your grandma. But this world is just something else. And it's not just black men. It's a whole lot of females and a whole lot of males. And females from other nationalities, too. That is their way of living. They're no longer in the closet. They're out of the closet. And they're teaching it to the children. And they're getting married. And they're adopting people's children. You know, it's something else. You know, I'm old school. So all I can do is get on my knees and pray. And just keep myself straight. But it kind of reminds me of Sodom and Gomorrah. And when they're in our family, we just have to love them. You know, we can't just sit in judgment.
Okay. I know one of my pastors of the church said if they ever come to him and ask him to marry them, he's not going to do it. And I told him you'll be sued. That's how they sue people. You know, so this is something else. All right. Well, thank you, everyone.
Okay, thanks, Stephanie. Now, I would like to invite our caller to join us, whose area code is 352, and the last three digits of your phone number, 544. We certainly welcome you to the show because I can't remember if you've been on before, but we welcome you tonight. And if you would like to, you don't have to tell us who you are. You can tell us a little bit about yourself, but you don't have to. But we certainly want to hear if you would like to share with us what's on your mind tonight. So please go ahead. Okay.
You may just... Peace and blessing. What? Can you hear me?
Yeah, well, alaikum salam. Please speak a little bit louder, but go ahead.
Okay, hold on. Let me adjust this. This is Muhammad Abdullah. I was the former resident imam, founder of the first freestanding masjid in Las Vegas, Nevada. And
welcome, brother
man. Yeah, thank you. And I was invited tonight by a good friend of mine and study partner for life, cosmological, or I would say metaphysical study partner, and that's billionaire Hamid.
Yes, sir.
Patricia Hamid.
Welcome to our program.
Me. Yes, and I heard a lot about you, and of course, you know, I admired your father, and I'm so grateful that you have this forum going.
Well, we've been doing it, Brother Man, for 4 years.
Okay.
And Ms. Bianchi, who is our co-host, has been with us for that whole time, and others have joined us since then. But we enjoy doing it. We do it usually from an hour to about an hour and a half on every Saturday night, and God willing, we'll continue. We do plan to stop at 9 o'clock. This evening, but we want to invite you to share any ideas or thoughts that you would like to share while we're still on the air. Please go ahead.
Okay, alhamdulillah. I just wanted to inject this. Unfortunately, for many of us, our own personal lives have been touched by the rainbow. In terms of the homosexuality wave that has hit the world, really. But I do want to say this, that I have several relatives who are gay. They're good people. And I know a lot of gay people who, many of them don't even go to church, but they're good human beings. And I just want to make sure that my relatives know that we take a stand for what Allah stands for. And Allah stands for freedom of choice. We can't judge them, just like we can't judge homeless people, okay, because people's situations change on a dime. It's like Katrina can hit any time, a tsunami. So relative to them, we want them to understand that we realize the humanity. We have to realize the humanity of all human beings and leave their judgment to Allah. They all have their own individual stories. So we can't clump them all into one story. They're all destined towards hell, put them all on an island and kill them. No, that's extreme. What we should do is understand that they all have individual stories, and we can accept their right to choose without accepting their choice.
Well, yes,
right,
sir. I just want to...
From God.
Yeah.
From God.
That's
and,
right.
And so
that's right.
As long as they know we have that sensitivity, and that's the sensitivity of the prophet, that's the sensitivity that's clocked into the DNA for our fellow human beings, then we could come to an understanding and deal with them on an individual-to-individual basis. Because we can't profile them just like they can't profile us African-American people because we're not the same. So that's just my little two cents, my brother.
Yes, sir. Well, thank you very much, Ruddy, man. What we're going to do, since we only have about 7 minutes left on the time that I've allotted for tonight, we're going to go back through the list or go around the circle from starting with you and then going back to Sister Stephanie, Sister Baina, and then Brother St. John Kennebay, then Brother One, and ended up with our co-host who used to close us out. But I do want to respond by saying this. You know, I grew up in a small town. I grew up in Tuskegee, Alabama, mm-hmm. and there was probably less than 10,000 people in that whole town, and about half were black, half were white. So everybody pretty much on the black side of town knew everybody. And I remember among my circle of friends, what we would say contemporaries, that we had several guys, and we're talking about grade school now, I'm not talking about adults, you know, later, you know, mm-hmm. I knew them in the same way. They didn't change throughout life, but I knew them as children. I'm talking about, you know, 8, 9, 10-year-old mm-hmm. children and coming on up. Mm-hmm. And they had feminine characteristics, and they weren't ashamed of it. And we didn't throw rocks at them. We didn't push them around. We didn't harass them. They were our friends. We accepted. We knew they were girly. You know, we might call them sissies, but we didn't mm-hmm. do it in a way to try to hurt them.
Yeah.
That's just who they were, and we accepted that. But now they weren't at the age, which maybe later when they got in high school, but I wasn't living there when these folks were in high school, where they mm-hmm. were actually what we call, you know, hitting on any of us. You know, they were just acting like, you know, they had a little girly characteristics about them. Now, they did not, you know, at least coming to school and coming to the playground, they'd wear dresses. I don't know what they did behind closed doors at home. And they weren't what they call, to some extent, some of them might have been flaming. You know, some mm-hmm. of them were more feminine than others.
Yeah.
And I'm only talking about 4 or 5 guys. I'm not talking about a whole mm-hmm. crowd of people. But my point is that, you know, we accepted them. We did not judge them. We did not ridicule them. We did not push them around. You know, we just knew that they were different, and we accepted their difference because that's just how they were. But we judged them on the basis of their character, and their character, they were nice
exactly.
folks. They were nice people.
That's it.
So anyway, mm-hmm. I do want to go ahead and give everybody a chance to do a quick, you know, closing summarization or closing remark. As I said, you know, going back through Sister Stephanie and then Sister Baina and then Brother Sheikh John Kennebay and then Brother Warren, and closing us out will be our co-host, Ms. Priyanka.
Can I make a quick statement here?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to tell you, sister-in-law Stephanie, I didn't know that she was having those type of health issues. And I hope that everything works out well with you. Stay strong. And, you know, hang in there.
Yeah, we'll keep in.
I've been going through this for, like, the past 3 years, and I'm fine so far. Yeah, we're all going to get something going.
Yeah. Our whole family is with Stephanie and really praise and supports. Stephanie, she is one strong sister. And I have to say that because she's literally my sister-in-law, but she's one strong lady. So I'm sure she appreciates it. I know I appreciate hearing it. But Sheikh John Kennebay, you'll be coming up. But right now, I think it's Sister Stephanie's turn, and then Sister Baina, and then we'll come to you, Sheikh John Kennebay.
Yeah. The thing that I wanted to discuss tonight, I guess maybe we can get it on the agenda for next week, and it's these people that they are bringing over from Haiti and different countries and the job situation here, are they looking for subservience. That's it. Are they looking for a new subservient here in the United States, a new nigga? I don't know.
I don't think they brought these people over here. Let me say this, Stephanie. These people are great risk to their lives, from what I read, travel because of the devastation in Haiti of the hurricane and the earthquake and political situation. And some of them came to Central America even before all that happened because they want to get away from the bad conditions over there.
Exactly.
Yeah, but America didn't import those people over there. These people came over there because they were seeking refuge to come to a better situation.
Yeah,
exactly. You know, I mean, and let me just say this, and I want to move on because we don't have much time. But I think what we have to understand is that American TV and internet now goes all over the world. And people get this picture of America being the land of opportunity.
Yeah.
When I was stationed in Korea, when I was in the Army back in the 60s. And many of those people could not wait to get a ticket to come to the land of the big PX, they call it, to come to America. Because of all of the promise of being able to have a much better life. And so it's not just some corporation or some political organization is pulling those people over there to be, you know, the new slaves or whatever. And let me just say this in closing. I went to school, and one of my teachers was a Haitian. I went to a private Catholic school. And Brother Warren, you may be familiar to some extent with the lady that founded my school because she also founded Xavier University. Her name was Catherine Drexel.
Catherine Drexel.
Right.
And so anyway, one of the priests that taught me, actually taught me French, was a Haitian priest. And he used to tell us a lot of stories about Haitian. Now, Haitian had changed, you know, from the time that he was growing up over there in the 30s and 40s and became a priest in the 50s to what it was later, you know, some of the problems later. But the thing about it is what I was told and what I understood is those are some very industrious people. I mean, they're not like a lot of what I call stereotype of some people that a lot of people say they don't want people from these so-called asshole countries. I don't know about any black countries that are asshole countries. I think that was very cruel for him to say that. But I know Haiti is definitely a country that produces a lot of craftsmen and a lot of industrial people. So we should welcome those people to come over here because they will add value to our communities, I do believe. I just want to say that.
Thank you.
But Sister Baina, as we get ready to close, would you like to go ahead?
Yeah, I want to go ahead and say this, but I think everybody misunderstood what I was trying to say. I think there's a hidden agenda, even with the massive influx of all the influx of the immigrants that are coming in here. I think there's a hidden agenda to weaken the divine masculine principle of African American men. And to make African American people a second class citizens, third class citizens, fourth or fifth class citizens, even if you will. So I think you have misunderstood what I said. There are transgenders born every day, hermaphrodites. I'm not talking about people's sexuality or their sexual preferences. I'm talking about this hidden agenda that these people have. When you put a man out there with a pregnant belly, like he's a woman having a baby, you are weakening the divine masculine principles that God has instilled within an African-American male. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a hidden agenda here that has something to do with that meritorious Manumission Act of 1710. And I think that people misunderstood what I was saying. Thank you.
Okay, well, we're going to go ahead and pick that up again if you want to next Saturday, Sister Baina. We definitely will not dismiss that. We'll continue it if you would like. So people can give their opinions concerning the hidden agenda issue. But thank you for bringing it up, and let's put it on the table and bring it up again next week for sure. So say, John Kennan Bay, would you like to offer something as we close?
No.
No? Okay, Brother Warren. Okay, fine. Brother Warren, would you like to offer more before we close?
Yeah, I'll be real quick. I just want to say that the Haitian migrants, most of whom were people who had left Haiti about 2010 earthquake, and they lived in places like Colombia. If you ever watched any of the news stories and they're speaking in Spanish. So these people, somebody was tweeting that border was open, okay? Somebody tweeted that, and that's how they all moved out like that. And see, a lot of these Twitter feeds, people are creating a lot of mass response to things with Twitter feeds. Now, we don't know if the Twitter message could have been a setup by people who wanted to see this conversion on the border or what. But I will say that the Afghans, the 60,000 Afghans that will be brought in with their child brides, and some of them may be Taliban members, they're going to have stores in the black community. They're not going to be on no jobs displacing nobody. They're going to be having businesses in the black community. And finally, I want to say that my travel to Africa this summer was the first time since 2019. I didn't travel abroad in 2020. But you should see the young African-Americans going to Africa. It is so inspiring. I was in Ethiopia and I was in Senegal. And from what I understand, there are a lot of young African-Americans going to visit. Some are even going to stay. They're having a great time. And I can tell you, the authorities in these African countries are letting you right through. They're not giving you no scrutiny. They're letting African-Americans right through. They're not bothering any African-Americans. And I saw this myself because I got through some checkpoints and just let me go. They checked the white people. They are excited. They want more African-Americans to come visit. They are really, really – because, see, now these young people are communicating with each other through these social media forums. So young African-Americans are able to communicate with young Ghanaians, young people in South Africa. And so the young people themselves are seeing the lies about Africa they were told is a lie. I have at least seven of my young family members who have been traveling throughout the continent. They were doing this during the pandemic. He said, I got one little cousin. She's settled down in Tanzania right now and enjoying. And so I just want to say that that is very uplifting. But I can tell you this, y'all, there's some people don't like it. They got some people don't like it. And so there's an attempt to get some African-Americans to go on this anti-black immigrant tirade that ain't working. It ain't working. White people are concerned about their diminishing numbers in this country. And so they need African-Americans to pick up a nativist mentality, an anti-immigrant mentality. And so they're investing in some black people who are promoting, who are attempting to promote division among blacks. But you should see the young black people going to Africa. It is really, to see them traveling, to see them leaving out of the United States to go see with their own eyes, it is really uplifting. And they're having a good time. They're having a great time. They're having a ball. That's what I want to contribute.
Well, thank you. I'm going to turn it over. Somebody has an echo coming back on me. I don't know if y'all can hear it. But anyway, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to turn it over to Ms. Bianchi to close us out. But each time that I set foot on the continent of Africa, and as I said, I have not been to West Africa, but I've been to Morocco, and I've been to Egypt, and I've been to Djibouti. And I've been to Djibouti twice, actually, and Egypt once, I think, maybe twice there, but Morocco once. I felt, just being on the continent, I felt like I was home in a way that I never felt at home anyplace else. And, of course, I feel at home in America because ancestors of mine, both American Indian, Caucasian, and African people, had given me roots here. But in terms of being accepted, that's a whole different story. Even though I have been accepted probably more in certain parts of my life than others. Like, for example, when I left Alabama and I went to New York, I felt a lot freer, a lot more accepted than in segregated Alabama. I went to New York when I was about 16 years old. When I went to California, different parts of California, I felt more accepted than others. Like, I felt very accepted in Oakland because that's 60-70% black. But there were parts of Oakland where I could not rent a house. But when I went to Africa, everybody I came in contact with in those countries I visited accepted me with open arms. In fact, when I went to Djibouti and I announced that I was a Muslim, the brothers embraced me, hugged me, and almost shed tears the same way if you saw the movie in the 70s, Roots, with the Alex Haley production, Roots. That's how they treated me. And it made me feel so much at home. And I know that I would love to go back sometime while I can still get around relatively well and travel through West Africa. So those of you who have visited West Africa. Maybe you could share during the program some stories about your experiences in West Africa so that we'll know a little bit more how to behave and what to expect when we go there. But I do thank you all for sharing what you've shared. So, Ms. Pianchi, it's time to close out for tonight, and we'll turn it over to you.
Well, it was a nice discussion. I hope Warren can come next week, tell us some things about Big Mama Thornton and Hound Dog. Hound Dog and Little Willie was two instrumentalists that I really enjoy listening to, especially when they be playing that harmonica.
Now, Pianchi, go to my show called Black Women in Rock and Roll. I interviewed a black lady who did a book on that, Black Women in Rock and Roll, and Big Mama Thornton was one of them in there. Also, with Tina Turner was a part of the discussion, too.
Yeah, Big Mama was a big lady, too.
Big lady, too.
But, no, it's people around the world are friendly. Africans are friendly to just about anybody, from my experiences with them. I didn't know that you spent time in Egypt, Mr. Washington. I think I spent maybe 7 or 8. I know I spent over 7 years going down as far as the northern Sudan border on digs that date back 65,000 years. I wouldn't like to live there. It's just, you're talking about a hot place. Some places, like down there in Aswan, at one of the monuments, the Hatshepsut Tekenu, we were down there one day. It ain't nothing for it to get up to 140 degrees. And that type of temperature, if you walk fast, the hot air will kind of blister your skin. It seems like razor blades. But people are people all over the world. Some solemn times in those countries, in Ethiopia. I like West Africa better. I wouldn't care to live on the east side because it's just a different people, different culture. Your culture that you experience here in the United States, you would, and even the cuisines, you would probably be more adaptive to West Africa. Egypt, no, I don't think so. But, you know, some people have the ability to adapt to just about anything. But I'm happy to hear everybody's safe. There's a lot of new revelations coming about along on COVID. I see where Florida has taken on a new Surgeon General who's a Nigerian who came out of the universities there in California. He moved to the United States when he was 5 with his parents. And his name is Joseph Ladapo. And the thing I liked about him, you know, he spoke some real good things. But people, you know, he said he's against mandates, and he has some particular critique about masks. And I see where the news media is jumping on, and they're being cautious because of his skin color. But, heck, the Atlantic Star came out and lied and said he's against vaccines. He never did say he was against vaccines. So those are the kind of things that continue to go on and how people like to inflame stories and so on and so on and so on end up with the misunderstanding that we run into. But anyway,
okay.
I'm going to get out of here and let you guys have it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Pianchi. We appreciate it. Judy just joined us, and I'm certainly glad that you joined us. We were about to wrap up, but we don't want to wrap up before we have a chance to hear your input tonight. It's caller's choice. We've had a couple people that left because I said we were going to close out around 9, but we're not going to close out till we hear what you want to contribute, because caller's choice means that you can bring up anything that's on your mind. You can share it with us, and if you'd like to have our feedback, we'll certainly be happy to give you some feedback. So, Judy, do you have something that you would like to share with us tonight?
No, I just say greetings. I was on for a while, but I don't think you could see me on, and I tried to talk a few times.
I didn't see you on my dashboard. You were down at the bottom,
yeah.
And I just now saw you. I'm sorry.
But that's okay. I enjoyed what I did here. I heard the last 20 minutes, and it was wonderful. And I wish everybody many blessings and enjoy this beautiful fall weather. And that's all I'm going to say. Good night.
Okay, well, good night. Good night, everyone. We want to say thank you on behalf of all of our panelists, and we want to invite those who are listening via the Internet next week to please join us so you can be part of our panel discussion. And we hope that everybody will still stay safe and be aware of the fact that COVID is not going away anytime soon. We just have to protect ourselves against becoming infected with it. And there's ways we can do it that were announced early on when it first hit. And we need to go back to doing those things because they will work. So thank you again for listening. And we close now with our theme song. Our closing theme song, Lift Every Voice and Sing.